can't be involved in every phone call and personal conversation. And just, I'm sitting here reading that thinking, knowing you for a couple of years, was that one of the larger things that you had to, and I'll do this in air quotes, but let go of? All right, guys, listen to episode 72 and hear how Dr. Jeff answered this question and more.
From the in-office studios of his eye care practices in Nashville, Tennessee, it's As I See It with Dr. Jeff Kegaris, your source for eye care education and receiving the type of patient relationship you deserve. It is time for a patient revolution. And now, your host, Dr. Jeff Kegaris.
Welcome to As I See It. I'm Dr. Jeff Kegaris, and I'm joined today by a really great friend, one that I don't get to talk to too often anymore because we're in disparate parts of the country and because I'm busy running these eye care practices, and she's busy gallivanting around the nation and internationally helping improve healthcare. But Margie Godfrey is a good friend, somebody that I've worked with before and have learned from extensively. And let me give you a little bit of background. About 20 years ago, I met one of the most knowledgeable and influential people that was passionate about improving healthcare and was willing to share her expertise, and that is Margie Godfrey. Margie's a registered nurse by training. In addition to her Master's of Science in Evaluative Clinical Sciences from Dartmouth, and more initials than her, after her name than I can even remember, all of which attest to her extra credentials and pursuits of healthcare improvement. She's currently, and almost coming up on a year, the executive director of the Institute for Excellence in Health and Social Systems at the University of New Hampshire, and a professor of research in the Department of Nursing after spending 25 years at Dartmouth in the Dartmouth Institute for Health Policy and Clinical Practice, where she founded the Dartmouth Microsystem Academy and taught graduate students improvement based on clinical microsystem research. Wow, what an introduction, Margie. And that's got to make you feel like, man, I've done all that, right?
Well, thank you, Jeff. It's interesting. There actually is an important one that we didn't include.
Oh, did I skip over something more important? Tell me about it.
Not more important, but it actually is. You know, after, 15, 20 years of trying to make a difference in healthcare improvement and realizing I still wasn't hitting the mark and maybe I needed more information, I actually studied and completed my PhD in Sweden.
Oh, fantastic. I wondered where you got that PhD.
Yeah, my PhD is from Jönköping University in Jönköping, Sweden, where I spent almost 20 years working with the region Jönköping Council, helping them improve the health and social systems in Jönköping County. Mm-hmm. They're probably typical European, but they combine health and social systems within their county where they have one bucket of money, and they have a council that sits together and talk about health and social systems and how they can create a good life and a good place for their citizens. So that seemed like the place that I needed to study. And I actually, my PhD is in leadership, improvement, and innovation in nursing at the university.
Hmm. So it's interesting, as long as you brought that up, that many countries, European, in this case Sweden, tend to kind of redefine healthcare as more than just, you know, seeing a doctor and getting your care, right? They have a broader view of what healthcare is.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, I stole the idea from my Swedish influence on our website, clinicalmicrosystem.org, the landing page says, live a good life in a good place. So if you think about that, it's a very high level statement about a good life. If you were to drill down into it, gets into the health of the population, the various diagnoses that the population has, and to live a good life in a good place gets into the context, my environment. What helps me to live a good life? Do I, you know, do I have the infrastructure that I can go for walks and ride bikes? And do I have access to good food and fish? And do I have social activities that keep me vibrant? So that's where our model, Live a Good Life in a Good Place, came from, in that we don't necessarily have to get into improve the health of people with diabetes or, you know, whatever the diagnostic group is. It's ultimately, we all want to do that, don't we?
That's a much more inspiring and aspiring goal than just be healthy.
Exactly.
Yeah. So exactly. How did you originally get in, move from nursing into your deep interest and passion for improving healthcare?
That's a fun story, because I've always been a very busy person, and I like to be efficient. And my first job when I graduated from nursing school was I landed a job with a general surgeon, and the general surgeon had me working in his office, had me assisting in the OR, and had me following patients in the postoperative period. So I really got the full view, the full continuum of care, inpatient, outpatient, pre-surgery, surgery, post-recovery. And in his office, he had a terrible physical flow of the space. And mind you, at that time, I was all of like 21 years old.
Just 10, 12 years ago then.
Yeah, it was just a few years ago. And you know, I suggested, because he had doors that weren't being used, how about if we had a circular flow rather than backtracking back and forth from his office to the exam room to the receptionist and everything. And he encouraged me to redesign the physical space. And then there was repeated procedures that he did that he would give them instructions. And I said, why don't we have written instructions that are standardized that we give to everyone? So I was trying to make it better for patients and families, but also make it better for us. And then we ended up figuring out, okay, as a registered nurse, what could I do if he got called out to surgery? Because it was a small community hospital that he worked in. So I can remove sutures, and there were other things I could do within my scope of practice to continue the office while he went back to the OR. And then that transitioned into my role at Mary Hitchcock Hospital in the cardiology department, and the inpatient cardiology, where I realized by understanding populations and when people arrived and left, so their length of stay, you actually could probably design a different model of care where there was primary care nursing. So I particularly liked surgery and studied the different types of surgical procedures and when patients arrived and left, and said, gosh, if we had primary care with associate nurses, we could have a constancy, a continuum here of two nurses who know you very well. One will always be there, and we could actually result in more efficiencies, more satisfaction as a staff nurse, because I know the patients, and actually, frankly, more accountability. Days I didn't feel well and didn't want to go in, I had to go because I knew my patient was going home that day and I wanted to be there. And then from there, I went to the post-anesthesia care unit, where I eventually became the director at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center, and realized, again, flow and delays. And through collecting data on patients, realized the number one reason why there was so much variation in length of stay in the post-anesthesia care unit, when I studied all the processes and collected all the data, was hypothermia. So that ended up with an upstream impact of changing the warming devices in the operating room. We shortened the length of stay, had better staff and patient satisfaction, and actually better outcomes. So that's a long story of getting me out of clinical care into improvement. I was constantly thinking about it.
You know, what I think is important to realize, though, too, is that you didn't just, you know, study some of this stuff in a book and say, hey, here's what ought to happen. You live this stuff. And by virtue of that personal experience, that makes all the difference, doesn't it?
I think it really does. And I we did some testing. I didn't know I was doing PDSA cycles at the time. You know, we tried out new ideas. You got to measure to know if it was an improvement or not. And I actually am a huge fan of, and even now, and have for years, been a believer and promoter of experiential learning. Uh-huh. It's one thing to read a book and then think you're going to perform. It's quite something different if you can are able to provide bits of information, have discussion and reflection about it, go try it out and come back and discuss and reflect. And interestingly, Jeff, that was the number one thing I realized in my doctoral studies, that if we look at, and you and I are very familiar with this, with the breakthrough series of IHI, the thing that was missing in the improvement work I was doing over the years was this role of a coach. And the original microsystem research, many of the physician leaders who are learning how to do improvement and then testing it in their own practices, going back and forth, were the coaches. Not only were they the teachers, they were also the coaches of the interprofessional teams and office practices. And I realized that role sort of faded away a bit. Based on Donald Schoen's work on reflective practitioner. So that's where the team coaching model emerged. Mm-hmm. Was my effort to say we need coaches to mm-hmm. help keep us on track, to encourage us, to praise us. And that was my thesis, basically, to understand how can we make a difference. And it's all about experiential learning. It's all about the human experience.
Do you think that that's been readily accepted, or do you still run into a lot of pushback on, oh, well, that'd be nice to have, but we can't afford that. We can't afford to do it right. We just want to keep doing it the way we're doing it on the coach level.
Yeah, I think there's other variations. You've heard of primary care practice facilitators. Uh-huh. I did a lot of work with Ed Wagner and the McCall Institute looking at the practice facilitators and Tom Bodenheimer. Those were specific to the standards to become primary care medical home. And the model that I developed is a bit higher level, that it's a generalist model, if you will. It's not specific to the actual interventions as much as how do we create the conditions to be successful. And I think for the most part, probably my experience has been over 50% of organizations and leaders like the idea of a team coach. It's not an individual coach, it's a team coach. Mm-hmm. Because of the fact they're busy. There's a lot of things the leader has to attend to now in healthcare systems. And to know that there's someone who is helping build improvement capability at the front line called a team coach and increase and improve team dynamics and communications and relationships and has sustainable improvement over time is appealing to them. Mm-hmm. If you look at an organization, if you take the square root of the total number of employees in an organization, that gives you the number based on Deming's modeling as to approximately how many team coaches you need to help coach improvement throughout the organization. Mm. It's actually a model Sheffield Teaching Hospital under the leadership of Tom Downs used in starting our very first team coaching academy outside of the United States in Sheffield, England.
Do you find more of this being implemented at larger organizations like hospitals, or do you find it in chronic care facilities, ambulatory care facilities, outpatient practices like ours, or is it a real mix, Margie?
It's a mix. It really is. I had a chief executive officer from New Mexico call me a month ago, small practices, and he was looking for some help. And he shared a perspective that I have, having gone through COVID and post-COVID, who was interested in improvement work. And he said, I cannot start with the technical aspects of improvement now. He said, it's got to be about people. And he said, I bought all of my leaders quality by design, uh-huh. because you start with the patient in the center and you start with people. And how can those providing care learn about themselves, have the time to reflect about what they're doing, to identify opportunities for improvement and test those ideas? So I think that it doesn't matter, big or large. It can be big scale. I've got almost 20 years of work partnering with the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation, and they have over 200 CF programs across the United States, and all of them have gone through an improvement collaborative with team coaching and will speak hands down the benefit of having a team coach encouraging, reminding, clarifying, teaching, and helping.
As I See It, we'll be right back.
Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Jeff Kegaris with Cool Springs and Donaldson Eye Care. We've proudly served the Middle Tennessee community for the last 26 years, and I want you to know we really appreciate you. Having an annual comprehensive eye health and vision exam is so important to the health of your eyes. From signs of diabetes, glaucoma, and cataracts, we're looking for it all. Don't let another day go by. Schedule your annual eye health and vision exam at Cool Springs or Donaldson Eye Care.
And now, back to As I See It.
When you were at Dartmouth and the microsystem work that you did, tell us about the P's that you had as your, if you will, some of your byline there. We know we had process there, which again, getting back to quality by design, if people misinterpret, they think, oh, that's all about just standardization of processes and that. They're missing the other very important P's in that. But tell us about microsystems and what P's you used there for people to pay attention to.
Well, the very cool thing is with the original microsystem research that was led by Paul Batalden and Gene Nelson and Julie Moore and now Julie Johnson, you know, we understood the importance of understanding context. And there's so many researchers and thinkers that promote understanding context. Donna Bedian was one of them. He talked about structure, process, and outcomes. And what's important with that is we took that model and said, let's add a little more detail at a microsystem level. Mm-hmm. So we actually started with four P's, which were patients, professionals, processes, and patterns, that if we understood current performance in current context, it would give us great insight into how things run, what's going well, and what might need improvement. I had tested that in Europe and the U.S. For several years and realized an assumption that had been made is that everyone knew their purpose and it wasn't true. So when you bring an interprofessional team together to do this work, no one does the work for them or to them. We do it with them and they have this time to reflect and learn about things they've wanted to do anyways that they never had the time for, that they ended up identifying why do we exist, which is purpose. Why are we here? And we heard things from a secretary who said, I'm here for the paycheck and the insurance because my husband's self-employed. We heard things from, you know, I want to provide evidence-based care and I want to go back to school. We heard everything. And out of that discussion amongst an interprofessional team, they would identify the purpose of their microsystem and then move into patients. Most people think about their patients in the morning or afternoon session or my assignment for the day. Mm-hmm. They don't have the opportunity to rise up 30,000 feet and say, who are the patients? What are their ages? What are their top diagnoses? Because you begin to see different models of care when you start thinking about if I'm 80 years old, living home alone, what should that care look like versus someone who's 24 years old, quite healthy and working? And then looking at who are those professionals caring for those patients. And then how do we get the work done, the processes? And then patterns, this is one of the, I think I'm very proud of, advancements that we've done. Patterns was really looking at, it's intended to look at patterns of outcome. So it can be performance numbers, but it's also intended in a broad sense to look at culture. Who talks with whom? Do we do things socially outside of the workplace? Do we have pictures of staff on the wall? You know, what are the patterns that someone can see artifacts of culture? Mm-hmm. And I met Jody Hopper-Gattell, who's the researcher and founder of Relational Coordination. And it was very cool because it was about how we communicate with one another and what types of relationships that we have based on seven dimensions that she had researched. And so now that in our new book that's coming out, Quality by Design, second edition, includes relational coordination in the pattern section to give you something more discrete to hang on to rather than this abstract culture thing that I can actually look at. Do we have timely, accurate problem solving communication? Do we have mutual respect and shared goals? I mean, so we continue to grow this to make it easy for people at the front line to see things differently rather than the frustrations they face regularly in trying to deliver care, and see that they have an opportunity to make a difference.
So let's talk about some of the care, because you and I worked on Institute for Healthcare Improvement work with the idealized design in clinical offices with Drs. Berwick and Kylo, and certainly with Batalda, Nelson, Julie Moore, you, and at Dartmouth, and the microsystem work. We've made gains. Let's look over the last 20 years, because nothing changes that fast in healthcare, even when we see that things are successful. But we've made some gains in other areas we haven't. So if I can break down some of these over the last 20 years, what do you see in the area of clinical outcomes? Have we made improvements, or where do we struggle?
Yes. Yeah, yes and no. And we have a glaring example, Jeff. The COVID-19 pandemic exposed everything that we've been talking about for years that wasn't maybe public, but became very public, from access to care to having equity of care, to having staff that are supported and have everything they need to be the best that they can be. I think, you know, the pharmacology world has made major contributions. And I think specifically the cystic fibrosis world, they have Trikafta now, which provides higher levels of health and functioning for many people with CF that they don't even need to be looking at lung transplants anymore because they're so well. I think there's all of these technology innovations, from insulin pumps and other technology, our watches, for God's sakes. I mean, we can report our vital signs. We can send in our EKG. I mean, there's a lot that the public can do. But again, I think the biggest barrier of all of this is equity and access. And we saw that during COVID. Not everybody has an internet. Not everybody has computers. You know, it's that. Until all of that is addressed, we're still going to need to work hard in what I consider to be customizing and co-designing care based on individual patient demographics, location, context. How do we help them that way rather than provide blanket solutions that only work for some of the people?
Do you think in the United States sometimes we say, well, you know, that's an issue because of where you are. If you could just get to here, then you'll have this as better, rather than approaching it as meet the patient where they are. Do you see Europe does that any better than us? And or I mean, maybe COVID's a good example. Where has Europe done well with COVID, and where has their system not been as effective as ours in the United States?
Well, I don't think I'm in a position really to answer that.
Okay.
I know the Swedes have done phenomenal work. They've just applied improvement science all over the place. I mean, one of the things they did, Jeff, they had this massive factory building that they actually mapped out the flow in practice before people came for their vaccinations. They knew cycle times. They had volunteers from the community come in and help walk the elderly through the vaccination process. I mean, it's just amazing. It was everything that we teach and know that they actually put to practice before they went live. And I think that, you know, I look at in Boston, again, you use the phrase meeting people where they're at. That's absolutely 100% without judgment what we have to do. The Boston T actually loaded up with vaccinations, and at each one of the stops, they got out and gave people vaccinations, and people in the community were like, thank you. There was no way I could get in to get these shots done. I wouldn't have done it if you hadn't come. If you look at the rapid progression that we've been trying to do for decades of telehealth, that's made a huge difference. You hear the stories of families that don't have to have a sitter or don't have to ride a bus for 2 hours from Oakland to Stanford for care, that they can use telehealth to do it now. And overnight, all of the barriers that we've heard of all the years, from regulatory, from government, from insurers, vanished because we had no choice and people needed to be cared for. So I think it's a combination. And I actually, our youngest daughter, undergrad was sociology. So she's always had an interest in our general well-being and the health of our country. And she and I were talking the other day. She's now an attorney, a big law attorney, and she's done a ton of pro bono work helping those less fortunate than us. And, you know, her comment, and I think we concurred on this, is the opportunity here is that we've got to be able to provide access and opportunity to individuals. We cannot guarantee their outcomes. Mm-hmm. It's the choice they make. But how do we make sure everyone has access to education, to good health care, to good living conditions that they contribute to be able to get the outcomes they're desirous of? And I believe that's probably right. We can't do it all, which is why we need everyone. When, you know, I left Dartmouth thinking about a microsystem, care and living a good life in a good place is about health and social systems. How do we all come together to create the systems in place and the opportunities for people to choose to participate in to get the desired outcomes and the good life that they're looking for? And at UNH, that's what I've been able to move from, is a microsystem to also knowing mesosystems, multiple microsystems, mm-hmm. macrosystems, multiple organizations working together. How do we all come together around a population, recognizing unique cohorts and designing things that make it easy for them to do the right thing, to have the opportunity to health, education, and a good place to live? The choices that they make. How do we do that? And we actually, I think, could be more efficient. We could engage more people in it and find out we have more resources than we ever realized. You know, we tend to think that, you know, we don't have enough resources when, in fact, we just haven't aligned ourselves or played together right to get those resources activated.
So you need somebody that kind of combines these silos together and says, this is important. You guys need to talk to each other, not just maximize your own microsystem, right? This needs to work with that, and that needs to work with this. That
Which
takes
is why
some leadership.
Yes, definitely. 100% leadership. That always boils up to the top, is that I've got so many different studies of where leadership changed or fell off, and you can have strong teams, but you still need to navigate the bigger system. Mm-hmm. And I think the interesting thing for me is I've had some conversations with some ministries of health in the Middle East, which was interesting to me. I assumed they had health and social systems together, and they don't. They have a ministry of social services, and I was like, you're kidding me. You know, so we've sliced and diced a system so much that we can't play together. So how do we then, you know, blur those boundaries and see how it's all connected? I think there's opportunities for that. And it does definitely take, I think, courageous leaders to do that.
Yeah, and it takes some time. That stalls the system. It stalls the readily adaptable method of making it happen, right? Well, we got to get them to agree. First, we got to find a time that we can get together and you know, break down some of those barriers. It's interesting you mentioned about COVID, because sometimes a crisis forces innovation. And let's hope that some of the things that looked like they made sense before that worked with COVID, let's hope that we don't go back to the same way and build all these walls and regulatory burdens that prevent that access for a much needed population.
And Jeff, you did bring up the number one problem I find all over the world, and it's time. Hmm. We have expectations that are unreasonable. I always talk about when we're developing improvement capability and working with people to give them the time to develop and grow, we have to give them the time. We were not born walking. It is a developmental journey. How do I get the baseline knowledge I need to participate? And how, if I'm interested, can I advance and go to higher levels? To expect people to go to a workshop and then go back and act differently is ludicrous. Mm-hmm. It's got to be over time reinforced by leaders at all levels, and conditions created where we actually change our behaviors and say, Jeff, you went to, you know, this series over the past 6 months. What should we be doing differently? So that takes us to one of my newest mentors, who's Edgar Schein. And Edgar Schein is 95 years old. He's the father of culture and organizational change. And one of his books that he wrote which was, I think, most mainstream, was the book Helping. And Helping really put into perspective what we need to do for each other, along with the idea of humble inquiry, being curious and asking good questions rather than telling all the time. And those were life-changing for me. And I've had like a 10-year mentoring relationship with him that he's so graciously given his time and poked me and encouraged me along the way.
That sounds like a good book for my leadership team and me. I haven't read that one.
Oh, and there's a whole series, but the other one, Helping, Humble Inquiry, Humble Leadership is very good, Jeff. Talks about the level of leadership we should strive to get to have these high-performing teams. And no surprise, Ed's from MIT. He also is a good friend of Amy Edmondson and actually handed off to her the whole idea of psychological safety in the workplace. So all of his materials feed into Amy's work to create this high-performing team. And where we have honest, open conversations, mutual respect and trust, and also psychological safety.
You know, it's always fascinating to talk to you because you help me. Just when we start thinking that we're doing a few things pretty well, I start saying, oh, we've got so much farther that we have to go. So for me, that's motivating. That can be a little bit, darn. But I love that. And I love the work that you're doing. If you're just listening and have tuned in, we're talking with Margie Godfrey, who is currently, let's see what, I'm trying to make sure that I have this correct, the Executive Director of the Institute for Excellence in Health and Social Systems at the University of New Hampshire. She is really somebody I've learned a tremendous amount, has influenced me tremendously. If you're getting some of the type of care that you want to get in our offices, in any of our businesses, it's directly has flowed through me via many of Margie's teaching. So I really appreciate you spending some time with us today, Margie, on a kind of the higher level look at where we are in healthcare. I do have one kind of world hunger question for you at the end, because we're going to have some other sessions, other podcasts in the future that get a little more specific, but this is a difficult one and it's kind of a hot potato. So if I mention a few facts in eye care, macular degeneration, much more prevalent in Caucasians than blacks and Hispanics, glaucoma, much more prevalent in African-Americans than it is in Caucasians. We got a higher prevalence of diabetes, thus we have a higher prevalence of diabetic eye disease in Hispanics. So we have to, by being a good clinician, we have to look both population-wise as well as in our own specific practice census that we have to be able to look at a person, understand their race, their ethnicity, their genetics, and say, these are the things that are of a higher risk. That's not being biased. That's being a good clinician. On the other hand, we're in a community culturally, socially now, where it's very difficult to differentiate at all. And some people are almost proposing this same for everybody. But if we give same for everybody, then we would be over-treating some and under-treating or under-looking at diagnostic issues with others. So help me with this. Healthcare should be, if you will, a way to connect the whole community, right? To know the individual, to know their individual risks based upon their social situation, based upon their race, but also to try to provide universally the type of care that they want and need to everybody. So is this a subject that you have found more recently harder to bring up because somebody might say, oh, you're being biased, when in fact you're trying to provide better health care to everybody?
Well, it is world hunger, as I said at the beginning of this, and I think you admitted to it too also, Jeff. There's a lot to do. We're not ready to retire. We still have too much to do. I do believe some of the ways that all populations have become more interested in participating in living a good life in a good place, that we need to include them in the process. We can't continue to do things to people. Inviting them into the process to learn with us and have them lead in their cohorts, in their subgroups, in their neighborhoods who know things better than we do, I think will contribute to this idea that you have about everyone having the opportunity for good health and social systems. So we can't pretend to tell anymore. We've got to engage everyone. And like I said, the more that we have people working across all sorts of ethnic groups, learning together, understanding their cultural bases, the more likely that we'll be able to move forward a lot faster.
Well, with that, Margie, thank you very much for joining us on this podcast with a little more of a global health perspective, certainly a national health perspective, and some of the work that you're doing. If people want to find out more about you and UNH and the work that you're doing in your department there, how would they contact you, or what website would they go to?
Yeah, I think the best place is the website that's never changed since the late 1990s, Jeff, based on our original research, which is clinicalmicrosystem.org. And it's singular, one word, clinical microsystem. And there you'll find news updates, bragging about all sorts of people doing good things, team coaching, communication and relationships, and improving healthcare improving health and social systems to live a good life in a good place.
Very good. Margie, thanks a lot for taking some time this afternoon. I really appreciate it.
It's a pleasure and an honor to catch up with you, Jeff. Thank you.
Thank you. And we'll look forward to next week's session on As I See It. I'm Dr. Jeff Kegras, coming to you live from Nashville, Tennessee.